Coming up on Digital Music Trends 176 on the 26th of March 2014, Rhapsody stops using the Echo Nest, the UK closes a loophole on digital download taxes, Pono closes in on the $5 million mark, music piracy on mobile devices, Shazam partners with Juno, Beats Music's first figures, Spotify's desktop client, and much more. This week's show is brought to you by Omniphone, the leading B2B cloud music provider powering global music services including Sony Music Unlimited, Guvera, Rara, and Sirius XM. Find out more on omniphone.com. And by MusicGraph, the world's first knowledge engine for music, available as a consumer app and as a graph API for developers. Check out musicgraph.com or developer.musicgraph.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Linali, and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as a video and an audio show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and many more. And to get in touch with the show, you can tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends or email contact at digitalmusictrends.com. Your feedback and word of mouth in circulating the show is essential, so please do share the show, tweet it, and share it within your network if you enjoyed it this week. And this week we have another packed show with some great guests, starting with Sitar Telly, a partner at Connect Ventures. So hi, Sitar, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's going really well.
It's great to have you. And so, and then we have Matthew Ogle, founder of This Is My Jam. So hi, Matt, and I can't believe you haven't been on the show before, so great to have you.
Yeah, likewise. Great to be here.
It's awesome. And, you know, I think we're going to start with a follow-up from a story that we talked about last week, actually. It wasn't long before another customer of the Echo Nest decided to pull the plug on their use of the service following the Spotify acquisition. So Rhapsody announced this week that they will no longer be using the services of the Echo Nest as a recommendation engine. And they also kind of hinted that they were never too happy with the results they got from the Echo Nest anyway. So kind of not too bothered about that. And it's kind of interesting because, of course, Rhapsody comes with Napster. So both Rhapsody and Napster are going to be pulling out of using the Echo Nest services. I mean, I'm not surprised just because I would have thought that any direct competitor of Spotify would have, you know, decided not to use the Echo Nest anymore. But do you feel like this really opens up the field to other companies coming into the fold and filling that space? Or will these companies try and develop their own tech solution around that? Matthew, what do you think?
Sure. I mean, I really think for companies that can afford it, I think, you know, the Echo Nest were absolutely the best in that game. You know, of anyone operating in the space, they were solving it best. But I think there probably was still some truth to Rhapsody saying, you know, the solutions were never quite right, because it really varies, especially if you have a service that's been around for a while that has a very particular set of use cases or users or styles of music. It's very difficult to make a one-size-fits-all data solution in the music space. So, you know, if they're for companies that can afford it, I think developing more competency in that in-house, you know, is always a good thing.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of it's always a problem, though, when we're talking about finances, to decide whether you're going to devote a huge amount of resources in developing an in-tech house solution, like in-house tech solution for this type of problem. Because we know how much energy is that, you know, the Echo Nest and similar companies have expanded into developing their tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, this is an area where I think it makes more sense for there to be an independent tech solution than for each company to build it in-house. Because I think it's actually an extremely difficult thing to build. Like what Echo Nest did was very, very hard. Yeah. And so for each company to replicate that effort is, to me, one, it's a waste of effort, and it's just unlikely that they're able to. I don't know that there's that many people around who want to work on this for music. I mean, because it's quite deep technically. There's a lot of people, there aren't that many people out there that want to work on it, and I don't think every company can. So I do think there's an opportunity for another company to come along. I don't know how big that opportunity is.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that I look at a lot, because I'm a VC, right? So I have to look in terms of what's the total opportunity. And I don't know how much Echo Nest was sold for. Was that public or not?
No. I think the rumors were around $100 million, but they're completely...
Right, which is, you know, it's a totally respectable amount of money, especially for how much they raised.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone should expect to build a company in that space that's going to be worth $1 billion or so, right? So I think there is an opportunity, and it's just a matter of having the right expectations. The issue with that is when the total opportunity isn't that big, because it's an expensive type of company to build, I think it's unlikely that there is another company in the space.
Yeah, Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, right? Because I guess we're going to see other third-party providers come in, but the question is whether the companies that want to use them are going to be trusting them enough to remain independent now.
Yeah, that's not a problem that's going to go away, I think.
Yeah, given they have been burnt already.
What wouldn't surprise me, and I'm sure some companies have already been doing this, is using a third party like the Echo Nest or someone like that to essentially bootstrap that part of your business
right.
until you're at a size where you know, it's simply a good business decision to make sure that you control the future of that part of your product, right?
Sure, that makes complete sense. And so I think we're going to see a few more developments in this space from the Echo Nest. And also, you know, we're going to see what Spotify does with the company. In theory, you know, they said that they're going to keep everything open as is now, but who knows what's going to happen in the next sort of 6 to 12 months. So, yeah.
I have a question about the acquisition, though. Was Spotify's main, maybe we don't know, but was Spotify's main reason for buying it because it powered Discovery or because it powered their radio?
I'm not sure. I think it's been seen as a consolidation move towards the IPO, but I think a little bit of both probably, and also the fact that if the company was on the market and they were looking for buyers potentially, then maybe they were worried that a competitor would pick up the company if they were relying on that tech. So maybe there was a little bit of both, I guess, on that front. And in the UK, actually, because all three of us are in the UK, so we have to discuss this little tidbit of news, the fact that the UK Chancellor George Osborne presented the government's budget last week, and one of the measures adopted is the closure of a tax loophole that allowed digital services to provide downloads for music apps and ebooks, but routed by other European countries that had a lower sales tax. So, for example, there were quite a few businesses based in Luxembourg, which only has a 3% sales tax. So as of January of 2015, all the digital stores operating in the UK will have to apply the full UK VAT, which is 20%. And this could raise the price of downloads by up to 17% for those digital stores that had been applying the VAT from Luxembourg or other similar sort of tax havens of that kind. I mean, the interesting thing is that as I was looking at this, I actually found that Apple doesn't have this tax avoidance in a sense, because they bank in Ireland and the rate there is 23% for VAT. So actually all of iTunes products shouldn't really be affected by this, theoretically, which is is a big portion, I guess, of the market still right now. But it could affect some other products from other companies, for ebooks and videos. So I don't know. Do you think that this is something that was overdue from the government? Is it too late for this to be implemented? Could it spark, if it does increase prices, a return of consumers going, well, actually, you know, I'm going to go and see if I can get this stuff for free, because they decided to raise prices by almost 20% all of a sudden. Sitar, do you have any thoughts on that?
So one, I think it probably is overdue. I don't know why you would tax digital goods. Actually, it's not that they were taxing digital goods differently. It's that they're allowing companies to just avoid taxes, which I don't really understand why you would let that go on. I think as consumers, it was a nice deal for a while. But the fact is, you know, it wasn't really competitive, I think, vis-a-vis other types of retailers.
Yeah.
And with regards to whether it'll get people to download more for free, no, I think, like, if you're willing to pay for something, you're already in a different subset of humanity, right? You're willing to pay for a digital product.
Yeah.
And if you're willing to pay, I mean, there are people that go to crazy efforts to not pay 99p. I don't know that the people that are willing to pay 99 cents for something are all of a sudden going to stop. You know, there is some elasticity of demand, but I think it's more, you know, once you've decided to pay, there's less elasticity there than getting people to pay.
Matt, do you agree with that? Do you think that this is not really going to affect people's perception of paying for music or books or films?
Yeah, absolutely. I still think the distinction is between I'm going to pay or not going to pay, rather than any sensitivity to something like that. And yeah, I mean, this is, I'm with Sitar, this you know, this decision feels a bit arbitrary, but that's pretty much the definition of a loophole, and it, I think it's good they're closing it.
Yeah.
If it were up to me, there are some other loopholes I'd work on too, rather than stiffing consumers with 20 pence, but it makes sense that they're doing it.
So. I would love to know if there were some like backroom conversations around this in previous years, which had to do with labels, you know, saying, well, you know, yeah, if you allow this loophole to happen, then we can get a bigger share of the 99p of the track, and then we're not gonna fight you as much on some other things. Conspiracy theories there can abound, I think. And you know, actually, segueing from that, there was an interesting story from Recode on piracy this week, and it was all about mobile piracy. So the report was from Dawn Chemielewski, I hope I did her surname justice, and she posted a piece quoting an MPD group study that found that mobile applications have eclipsed the file sharing services, online storage sites, and stream ripping software as the most widely used source of free music downloads. So that research estimates that 21 million people in the US have used peer-to-peer sites such as IsoHunt to download music, and the app Music Maniac, which the article states provides free access to all the tracks in the Billboard Top 10, has been downloaded more than 10 million times. So, and Google has not taken it down in spite of requests from the music industry. So it's an interesting space because there are a lot of YouTube ripping apps that are available today, and it's interesting that they're not being taken down. And there are also a lot of apps that allow you to download free MP3s, especially on Android devices. Apparently, there's an estimate of 250 apps that allow you to do that. So is this just a natural evolution of piracy, or can it turn into a real new problem as you know, we move on to LTE you know, nationwide here in the UK and in the US, and it becomes easier than ever for teenagers to swap and download files for free, which was like, you know, quite a difficult difficult thing to do up to, you know, maybe 12 months ago. Matt, from a tech standpoint, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, is it a new problem or will it be a growing problem?
Yeah.
You know, I think no. It turns out the internet in your pocket is still the internet and will do the things that the internet has done for the last 10, 15 years. I mean, in terms of ease of use, I still think, you know, Napster 15 years ago was still a better piracy experience than anything that right. we're talking about even today. And I also think that, you know, on mobile especially, we now have technologies and frameworks and practices in place for extracting small amounts of money from people that work way better on these than they ever did on the desktop. Yeah. And we've also learned a lot of lessons as an industry, both tech and on the content side, about approaches that do work against piracy, approaches that don't. And so I'm just hoping that, you know, we can bring all of those learnings to bear on whatever happens next. I do think the Android distinction is an interesting one. Google's kind of in a tight spot because they've staked their platform's, you know, differentiation yeah. on this openness and this lack of oversight and supervision. So it doesn't surprise me if that's happening there. But to me, that almost seems unrelated to the larger trend of, you know, if you do want free stuff and you have something connects to the internet, there will always be a way to find it.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping is that this just encourages all the players to make it so easy and so awesome and so enjoyable to pay a little bit for this content that, you know, we solve the problem that way.
Exactly. And an interesting part of it is because it is the fact that the IFPI reported the 4% slump in, you know, recorded music revenues for 2013 compared to 2012, where we had a plus 2%. So I'm just wondering whether the fact that the industry feels as if it is in a recession again, whether that's going to increase their efforts towards the fight with piracy, which in a sense had eased a little bit because it felt like, you know, streaming services were getting ground and it didn't feel as much of an urgent problem for them. But if they do see that recorded revenues continue to decline, maybe they're going to start turning, you know, paying a little bit more attention to piracy once again, and we're going to see a few more measures being taken and a few more battles on the front. Sitar, do you think that's possible?
Possible. I mean, I don't know. I have a pretty dismal view of the recorded music industry as an industry. I've met really lovely people that work within it. I just, you know, it's like when they get together, it's like the opposite of Voltron. You know, they turn into this evil monster. And it just, I don't know. It's so I don't think they're it to if recorded music revenues will go down. To me, that's just not a question.
Yeah.
And so I think they will continue to go down. And what I haven't seen the music industry do is really try to wholeheartedly embrace that change and restructure itself.
Yeah.
Still. And I think until that happens, they'll continue to fight it because they're not structured to exist in what is happening now and in what is going to happen for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And so people always fight the things that try to kill them.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And you know, talking about change, one story that I wanted to just mention, because we've been following it since it really started, the first rumors started around it, is Neil Young's Pono. So the Pono has now almost reached $5 million. It might reach the $5 million mark by the time the show goes live in a few hours. With still 20 days to go on the Kickstarter campaign. And while I stick to my argument that 30 or even 40 or 50,000 users don't make an ecosystem, or maybe a sustainable ecosystem in my opinion, the momentum is undeniable. He's getting a ton of press, and I think definitely getting somewhere in the way of raising awareness, which was really his main objective, raising awareness around audio quality. So Sitar, as a VC, I think we actually had a chat about this in the last show. You know, in the way that it's presented today, would you have backed the Pono, or would you have considered it?
No. I mean, I think it's interesting, but I think, you know, it's look, there's one of the best things about right now is you can find, using Kickstarter or a lot of other places, you can find the subset of people that really, really care about the things you care about and create a sort of small, sustainable business that way.
Right.
And I think that's what Pono is, right? It's finding the 50,000 or 100,000, even if it's 500,000, and I don't think it's 500,000, but even if it is 500,000, it's finding those people and delivering them exactly the product that they want, or at least a very close, you know, approximation of the product that they want.
Yeah.
But that's not a business. I think it's not a long-term business. It's just really satisfying a very specific need people have. I don't think it's backable. And I don't even know that it does that much to raise awareness, because the people it's targeting are the people who care about it.
Right.
And it's sort of, it's not going to, you know, get other people next to them to say, oh, I certainly care about audio quality as well. Right. The people who care about it. And it's a great way of finding them. And to me, that's what he's done.
Yeah. Yeah, Matt, where do you stand in the Pono debate? Have you bought one, or?
I haven't. I mean, as a Canadian, I can't think rationally about Neil Young. You can do no wrong. And I mean, I do. You know, Pono is solving a real problem. You know, as someone who recently reinvested in physical audio gear, and I'm by no means an audiophile, I now have a setup where I get a beautiful digital in from my online collection, mostly high quality MP3s.
Yeah.
But I also have a nice CD player plugged into the exact same setup. And I mean, the quality gap between MP3 and CD is very visceral, very real. You don't need to be an expert to hear it. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Something that kind of upset me about Pono is they kind of fell into the pseudoscience bucket of like, we're going to be 8 times better quality than CD, and diminishing returns set in really fast above, you know, it turns out the CD standard is pretty well modeled to how the human ear and brain function.
Yeah.
So sort of sad to see it. It felt a bit like a Monster cable ad, you know, looking at the science behind it. So that upset me a bit. But yeah, I'm a Sitar. Like, this is a product that should exist. I think there is an argument to be made for this. You know, I think 20, 30 years down the road, it would be really sad if we were in a situation where we actually started losing high quality recordings, especially of previous recorded stuff, as a result of there being no alternatives on the market.
Yeah.
You know, do I think Pono will displace, the iPhone as a mechanism for listening to music? There's just no way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to look at also the, you were talking about the preservation as well as sound recordings, and I actually attended a seminar, I guess, or, you know, a conference on Friday called Keeping Tracks, organized by the British Library's Sound Archive. And that was really interesting because they were talking about how they're going about trying to preserve sound recordings and making sure that at least the most endangered recordings that they have in their archives are being digitally encoded. And one of the interesting things about that day was the fact that they turned to independent labels to start this process. And they said that they haven't had much response from majors in terms of trying to get some response in getting their back catalog or managing to preserve some of their collection that is not currently being monetized. So again, you know, interesting stuff there. The British Library is working really hard on getting the recordings encoded in the highest bitrate possible if it comes from tape. So it could be a great showcase for the Pono. But as of now, I don't think they have a lot of popular content to play with because of the restrictions placed by copyright and all that kind of stuff. So an interesting game there. I know that the Library of Congress is doing a lot of work with labels and trying to at least get their archives. They can't really be accessed from anywhere but physically at the Library of Congress because of copyright issues. But at least they're trying to preserve the catalogs that they don't think labels are able or willing to maintain properly and keep at the right temperatures and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's an interesting debate around that, and I wonder what's going to happen in the next like 10 or 20 years as these tapes actually start degrading to the point that they're not listenable anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. It seems like for a few years now, there's always been this idea that just a few years out, something will happen in music tech that allows labels to really commercialize their back catalog more effectively. And I still believe there is an audience there, but I no longer suspect that, you know, there may not be, you know, through commercial incentives alone, we may not be able to preserve all that. So I'm glad that cultural organizations and others are getting on the case too, because it's important stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about independent labels, Shazam continues its wave of partnerships, and this time an important one with Juno Records, which will allow the company to add its catalog of music to Shazam, essentially, so that it will be Shazamable. This includes 4 million digital tracks and over 110,000 vinyl releases. The interesting thing about the vinyl releases is that those are also going to be included in the deal, so that releases that are not actually ever released on digital or that are not released on digital for several weeks after the vinyl release are going to be Shazamable, which makes a difference for people that are going to clubs and listening to new tracks that have been dropped by DJs. So a big deal there. 4 million tracks is a lot. And of course, with Ultra and Miami Music Week happening this week, that's definitely a good timing to announce the deal. But the interesting thing for me is that Shazam has been, it feels like it's been trying to get away from music in a sense for the last couple of years, and really highlighting their relationship with TV companies and, you know, their commercial capabilities for advertising. But really, it seems to always go back to music. You know, they announced the Warner deal, where Warner is setting up a label that is going to be driven, where artist discovery is going to be driven by Shazam, and Shazam is going to actually have a share of revenues from that. And so it seems like Shazam always end up going back towards the music, and with a valuation of $500 million now, apparently, it's an interesting space to be in. So Sitar, do you think that they are sort of toying, going back and forth with the idea of music or non-music, music, non-music, or is it just a natural evolution of the company?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know much about the internal works of Shazam, but if I had to imagine, I think, you know, they have a very, very, very strong user base in, you know, people who use Shazam to figure out what track is playing right now. Yeah. That's the core of what they do, and that's been the core of what they do for a very, very long time. And while they've been trying to expand into other areas, if I were them, I'd still... You know, what's good is that they're not giving up product or marketing development partnerships in the core of their product, right? The worst thing they could have done is to let the original Shazam product wither and just go totally into TV, which is speculative at best right now. So I don't see them as going back and forth so much as trying to expand their product base while still making sure they're serving the people who like to use their product well.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Matt, from your perspective, is there a lot of room to grow for Shazam still as a company in the music space?
Well, there's definitely potential there. I mean, they're faced with the classic problem, but as Sitar said, they also have a huge asset, which is they, you know, started as a utility.
Yeah.
And to this day, they still do an awesome job of satisfying that one use case that people, when you think of IDing a song, you know, it's nearly a verb like Google, you Shazam it, right? You know, people, myself included, have paid a lot of lip service over the last 5 years to music discovery and discovery services. And I mean, they're one of the few that can say they are 100% a discovery service. And I think, you know, I know they've been talking for a while about What can the follow-on actions be after you've Shazam something? Does your history mean anything? Should it be more shareable? And I think if they can pursue some of those things right, as well as some of this other stuff they're trying to do with TV, they might actually, you know, do that magic trick well, which is starting as utility, still performing that, but then becoming a wider service over time. I think, you know, they have a good a shot at pulling it off as anyone.
Yeah, sure. It's one of the most interesting companies in the music space, and it's not talked about enough, I think, as we concentrate on actual service providers, but they're really enabling a lot of the discovery when it comes to a live setting, or, you know, being somewhere and just wanting to know what the track is all about. So, and it's weird, actually. We're not hearing as much about SoundHound, so I wonder what's happening over there in terms of inner workings. But definitely, Shazam seems to be stealing all the headlines in the last few months, at least. Moving on to Beats Music. Beats Music has some interesting stats that came in from Bloomberg this week. The publication reports that the service, according to their sources, signed up around 1,000 subscribers per day in the first month since launch. So that's around 28,000 customers, although it has gotten over 750,000 people, apparently, which seems like a huge number, on the free trial via AT&T, with the first conversion rates of people that are ending the first one-month trials being as high as 70%. So a really great number there for Beats when it comes to the AT&T side, but pretty poor figures when it comes to the individual signups from people that are not coming through the AT&T funnel. So, Matt, do you think that these are subpar figures for a company that needs to scale to millions of users? Or is the whole play entirely based around carrier partnerships? And in that case, you know, the actual signup figures from users that are not coming through that shouldn't be a concern for the company.
Sure. I think it's almost impossible to judge anything by, you know, the first month or even the first 3 months of figures. I mean, if that conversion rate is real, and if it potentially could stay even remotely close to that number outside of AT&T context, then that's pretty interesting. Because, I mean, something that I honestly thought they'd do right out of the gate and that I'm sure they're saving is, you know, why they wouldn't offer a free trial with every pair of Beats headphones sold.
Exactly.
You know, if they can turn on other things like that and keep even a 30, 40% conversion, you know, then they'd be in great shape. So I think it's too soon to say. I think, especially in the US, I think paying for a streaming service is still new enough that things like trials and bundling are going to be super important for a while.
Yeah.
So just the raw, like, people walking up off the street and subscribing numbers, those being a bit low, I'm not sure that matters yet. Too soon to say, but I think there's some promise there.
Yeah, absolutely. Sitara, did you think that there's room to grow for the side that is not supported by AT&T? Or should they not even bother about really spending too much marketing money and getting people that are not on that plan yet, as they have such great figures on conversions right now?
Well, it's not so much that I think they shouldn't focus on people that aren't on AT&T. I think their main focus should be partnerships.
Right.
Because I think it's similar to Spotify. You know, the main growth channel is partnerships and going through an existing user base that already has the device or whatever that you need in order to use the service, and just pre-installing it or giving away to those people.
Yeah.
Because, at least according to this article, they need 5 million people to 5 million paying people to be profitable, which, I mean, if the history of the music industry is anything to go by the time they get to 5, it'll probably be 50. But if they do need 5 million, then actually directly signing up those people, I think, is actually the worst thing they could focus on. It is going through everything from celebrity endorsements, which are effectively like brands with millions of followers, to guys like AT&T and eventually Verizon operators and everyone else, and Beats itself, which I agree. I think it's odd that they aren't giving it away with the Beats headphones. but that should be their strategy, right? Because they need to, even with a 70% conversion rate, and I assume that'll drop, but let's say it drops to a 30% conversion rate. I mean, there's a lot of people they need to get to unless they want to keep raising money.
Yeah, and I think that conversion rate is so high also because I've been told that the the free trial becomes a paid subscription without much of a, in the way of notification. It's just a added to your mobile
bill. That doesn't hurt.
Yeah, added to your mobile bill, which is substantial anyway in the States. So I guess some people might not even notice that it's there. But I want to hear more about that as the 3-month trials start coming to an end and the family plans kick in. That's going to be, I think, the most interesting part of the play too. Going from, you're talking about you can't judge a service from the first month of existence, and that was certainly true of Twitter Music, because if you judge by the first month, probably you would have thought, it would have been like a relatively successful little app there. But Twitter announced this week that they would stop it working from April the 18th and actually remove the app altogether from the App Store. So no one was surprised, really, particularly considering the performance of the app. I do wonder if long-term this is having or has had an impact in other large networks' approaches towards music, like, for example, Facebook. Sitar, do you think that might be the case, and that people might be a little bit more circumspect when trying to come in bullish in a field like music that is actually really hard to crack?
I don't know. People seem to keep coming in very bullish in the music industry, which I don't really understand why. I think it's part of the bravado of the music industry, is that you have to come in big or you just don't come in.
Yeah.
I actually never even downloaded the Twitter Music app. I just never really saw or why I would. The problem for me is not finding new music. There's lots of new music out there and there's lots of ways to find it. It's more of finding it in a way that's sort of passive for me. Yeah. So for me, it just now, and I think it's actually far more people have this problem than realize. And so I just, for me, it didn't really solve a problem for me, and I didn't really understand why there was another music app that I should be downloading and using. So I guess that there was a lot of push behind it, but I don't know that, it's not like Twitter is going to do something quietly.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just that's just not going to happen, right? They pushed it heavily by having celebrities and stuff involved, but in general, I think whenever a very large company launched, I mean, Amazon launched, this big streaming service, again, there was a big push behind it, and it's just because when very large companies do things, there's always a lot of buzz about it.
Yeah.
But I always kind of evaluate stuff on the product itself and whether the product is interesting. And with Twitter, just the description of it was so boring that I just never really saw a reason to use it.
Yeah, makes sense. And another third party, software is not exactly what people need. This actually leads well into the next story, which was about Spotify. So Spotify has announced that it will stop accepting new submissions for the desktop client's app store, signaling that the days of third-party apps are counted at this point. I would imagine that if they stop accepting submissions, the next overhaul of the client might even see the disappearance of those apps altogether. So, this again puts the spotlight onto Spotify's API and the integration of that API into third-party apps that are acting as middlemen towards discovery. But as we've seen in the Twitter Music case, that's not an easy thing to do, because people it's hard to convince people to use a third-party app and signing in through Spotify when it's so much more convenient to just use a Spotify app. Do you think that this is going to hurt some of those companies at all? Or do you feel like consumers are savvy enough now to be quite happy using a third-party app through Spotify and listening to full tracks that way?
Sure. I mean, I can speak to this directly because This Is My Jam has a Spotify app.
Of course.
But for some time now, we'd actually been talking to Spotify about, hey, a lot of things that currently are happening locked inside our app, which only works in your desktop client, doesn't work in your web client or the mobile clients. Could we do some of that on This Is My Jam directly? A lot of users were saying, why can't I just connect, my Jam, my Spotify account on the website, and then things can happen. And in fact, Last.fm actually just did a nice Spotify integration purely on the website, but you can actually play directly on Spotify from Last.fm. So I actually think if Spotify makes good on their promise to do a wide release of the APIs necessary to do that kind of thing across both web and mobile, I actually do think that their platform as a whole, or the Spotify ecosystem, will be in better shape than it was when they were acting as gatekeepers and having to operate this little app store, and how do you root users through that? There were a lot of obvious problems there.
Yeah, and there was frustration as well, because not all apps got approved. So,
Exactly, and their approval process, I can speak from experience, was Apple levels of detail. I think there's an opportunity there for Spotify. I think there's still no, you know, paid for streaming service with a free tier that could claim to be the kind of plumbing for the musical internet. In some areas it's SoundCloud. Spotify does have widgets right now, but they're relatively limited in functionality. There's YouTube, of course, but that may be changing as well. So I do think there's an opportunity there if they do make good on the second half of this news, which is we're going to have a bunch of new great APIs for developers to work with.
Yeah.
I think it could be a good move.
Yeah. And Sitar, from your perspective as a potential investor, you know, do you think that becoming a platform rather than a service makes more sense for Spotify and become pervasive to the web, a bit like SoundCloud has done, makes more sense for them?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's interesting. I mean, from my own view, I think Spotify, so I'm not a Spotify investor.
Sure.
And I guess I am still a SoundCloud investor, and so I'm not entirely objective on this.
Yeah.
But that said, I'd say as a consumer and a user of Spotify, I have wanted an upgrade to the product for a very long time.
Yeah.
Like I can say that since I downloaded the mobile app to now, there's been very little change to the product, and it's getting to the point where it feels like a broken experience to me.
Right.
So from a user experience, I like a lot of the stuff that's on like what Matt was saying, like from using it, a lot of the stuff that's on the desktop client isn't in mobile.
Yeah.
And I'd really like it to be, right? Like I don't really like to do the seek and find on Spotify where you put in an artist and then you find it, because I oftentimes don't know what I want to listen to.
Yeah.
And I think the apps are a great way of layering on top of all of the content they have. I think there's even potential for them to add a business around that.
Yeah.
But they need to do some serious product development on that, both on the API level, but also I think on the mobile client itself from a user experience level. And so I hope this means they're going to be focusing a lot more on the product than they have, past couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's going to be a very fun space to see develop, and they might even open the API for up to for free users of a service to some extent. So that could be a very big opening of the API if they did that, because it would allow so many more people to actually use those apps as free customers of the service. Although, you know, then there's a whole question mark around conversions and, you know, the fact that having that premium layer allows for a lot higher number of conversions for people that open up the app and realize they can't really use Spotify on them. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they balance those two. And looking at the other thing that came out of Spotify actually was that they announced a half price discount for students, which is interesting in the US, I think, at least. I'm not sure if it's available in the UK. I think it's US only for now. But you have to provide a proof of being student, and then you get a Spotify subscription for $4.99 a month, which is a neat little discount for students that can't afford to pay the full rate. So yeah, that's cool. There's not much to comment on that. It's just a neat way of pulling people in and keeping them sweet, you know, like many newspapers do. There's a lot of places that do student discounts just to create brand loyalty and then retain them after they stop being students. So mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. And finally, I want to talk about Linkin Park as sort of like a extra thing that, you know, has happened in the music tech space. We haven't seen much in the way of bands going all out on game development for a while. And so Linkin Park showcased a 6-minute video of the band's latest single, Guilty All the Same. And the video is of a game they developed alongside Microsoft's Project Spark. So the project it's like a modular way of building games in a simplified way, I guess. It makes it a little bit more simple to develop your own game on the Microsoft Spark, Project Spark platform. At the moment, they are only available on Xbox One and Windows 8.1. But essentially what it does, it allows users to have this experience on a game level with a song, and it also allows them to remix parts of the song. So it's a dual approach, both in a gaming sort of adventure style context and in a music remixing side of things. So, you know, Linkin Park always, you know, they often do interesting things on the tech side. It feels like they're really interested in that. They They saw the demo for the Project Spark at E3 from what the frontman said, and got excited about it and wanted to get it included in their next release. So, Matt, do you think that there's still room for bands to experiment with this kind of thing, or are the budgets shrinking so much that it's becoming almost impossible for even big name acts to do this kind of stuff unless there is a brand involved? I mean, I guess in this case, Microsoft is probably footing some of the bill for the game.
Yeah, that doesn't hurt. I mean, budgets are shrinking, but also the cost of making your own game as a band 10 years ago would have been completely exorbitant. So yeah. Luckily costs are, you know, declining almost as quickly. I mean, I think it's really cool. When I was, you know, reading up on this latest thing with Linkin Park, besides being very surprised that two of the members of Linkin Park met in art school, I didn't see that coming. things like this, I think, are just great ways to connect with fans, to reconnect with fans that maybe haven't checked you out in a while. And there is, you know, because of some of the dynamics of the industry that Sitar described quite accurately recently, I think there's always a risk when a band does something like this to sort of try to see it as some new model for something, or, you know, oh, the future of music videos is games. And you know, I don't really think it's that. I think it's them being artists, you know, in the world that we live in, seeing an opportunity, seeing something interesting and thinking, hey, we can, you know, fuse what we do with this and probably, you know, get a few of our fans excited about our next tour or our next album or our next single, you know, as a result. And I think that's totally awesome. And I think we're just going to naturally see more of this, sort of whether or not the music industry notices or not.
Yeah, and if it's a demographic as well, so it makes total sense.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Sitar, do you think that this, again, is a one-off? You know, do you feel like, as Matt said, the development costs have come down enough for musicians to start being able to be more experimental with what they do on the tech front around the release, or not?
Yeah, no, I think musicians have been more experimental with what they do on the tech front.
Yeah.
I think that probably the best example of that was Björk's iPad app.
Yeah.
Around the launch, which was pretty amazing, right? I mean, that obviously.
Although on the money front, we're not quite sure about that.
Yeah, I was going to say that was probably quite expensive. And that's like, you know, she's as much an artist as she is a musician. So, yeah. So, you know, I think she had other reasons for doing it. But I know that also, actually, when Eric from SoundCloud launched his second album, which was a couple of years ago, he also did an iPad app and he didn't put a lot of money behind it.
Right.
So that was just something he chose to do. And I think, you know, it depends, right? I mean, musicians have different personalities. Not all of them want to be, or at least most are hopefully artistic. So if you view it as something, you know, you're creating something that's a piece of art, then I think it's good and you can do it. If it's, you know, it's another marketing channel.
Yeah.
Then I think, yeah, you'll probably see more of it. It'll probably be less interesting. And it's not going to be for everyone, right? Because not every musician, I mean, most musicians, I think, just want to make music.
Yeah.
And they don't really want to be marketers. And it'll probably be something that's more taken over by the labels as another marketing channel. And you know, if you look at what's happened with a lot of music releases and getting them into TV shows and commercials and video games, increasingly, I mean, it is another channel to access fans and to get people to discover music, which I guess Shazam plays a good role in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen the evolution of I've seen an article on the latest iteration of the Imogen Heap music glove, and it looks really cool. So I wonder if that's going to be made into an actual product or if it's going to remain a one-off thing. But I think that they do want to productize it somehow. It's going to be interesting to see how that works. It feels like there's a lot of innovation happening in the hardware space for music these days, and there's a lot of exciting stuff happening with devices and hand controls, wireless, gesture-based instruments. Definitely want to see more of that.
Totally.
Very excited. And finally, I just wanted to, I think I've covered everything. Let me just check that. I just wanted to sort of go through what's happening with you guys. First of all, Matt, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening at This Is My Jam?
Sure. So my co-founder Hannah and I are basically working on a really new, exciting version of Jam that hopefully the first sort of couple main features coming out of it should be released soon. And essentially, over the past 2 years at Jam, we've been asking our users around once a week to say, right now, my favorite song in the whole world is this one.
Yeah.
And they tell us a bit about it, and they sometimes upload an image. And it was meant to be slow music sharing that was a bit more deliberate, really good signal-to-noise ratio, only the good stuff, all hits, no filler. And just by sort of codifying that simple behavior, we've spent the last 2 years, at first without even realizing it, building up this incredible database of the best songs of all time. So sure. People have said, this song is my jam nearly 2 million times now, which is, small change in internet numbers. But when you consider that every single one of those was handpicked, carefully thought about, and posted, it's really valuable.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we're melting those 2 million jams down. It works out to just under 500,000 songs.
Cool.
And we are soon going to start exposing information on all those songs and also the connections between those songs and between the people who have posted them. We're calling that the song graph.
Nice.
We think it's going to be something pretty unique online. There's nothing quite like it. Watch in the next month or two for the first pieces of that to be shipping.
That sounds awesome. And hopefully we'll manage to do a piece on the show just on that at some point.
Sure, that'd be great.
Sounds great. And so Sitara, on your front, do you have any startups you've invested in that you want to talk about? Even if it's not music related, totally happy.
Yeah, although I'm conscious of then it becomes like advertising more than anything else. We love all of our investments are awesome. But in terms of... Actually, I don't know what I'm looking for, I guess, in terms of new investments. So in music, I have probably become increasingly frustrated with labels and anything that has to do with recorded music.
Yeah.
So I look for businesses that aren't trying to... And anything that starts off with, labels have a problem we can fix, it's almost like an immediate no.
Yeah.
Or anything that's like, consumers want to pay for music, they just don't know how. Again, it's like an immediate no. So I look for more stuff that's around the music experience.
Yeah.
So anything, music creation is a really interesting area, if you look at recorded music, it's an interesting industry. If you look at musical instruments, it's actually a massive industry, and that's annual. So that's a really interesting area for me. Anything that's around the experience of music, so live music, trying to make it kind of easier for people to get to shows or experience the music from their favorite bands in a different way. Anything around that I really like. I see a lot in ticketing right now, which is interesting because I would have thought like there wouldn't be that much left in ticketing, but actually there's a lot of software stuff happening in ticketing, which I find interesting. So it's there's all these middlemen and brokers in ticketing, and it's not a great experience for anyone really other than I guess the brokers. I've seen a couple of projects now, which is software that allows a venue to just sell tickets directly, which you think about before when you went to book an airline ticket and you had to go to a travel agent versus just going to the airline's website and booking tickets. I don't know if people listening to this will even remember. There was a time when you went to like American Airlines and it was just a corporate website. You couldn't do anything on the website. And there's a company that makes software that enables all of these airlines to sell tickets, which I didn't know. It's like a $1 billion company, and they just have software that allows you to sell tickets.
Wow.
And I don't know why something like that doesn't exist in events or in concerts.
Yeah.
So something like that is really interesting. But anything that sort of kind of, I think, is around the infrastructure of music or the creation of music or the offline experience of music is very interesting. If it's actually in... I have a service that'll stream digital music. It's just not that interesting. Because I think, it's become increasingly apparent over the years that just the recorded music industry is so, so difficult to work with that it's really hard to build a big business doing that.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And I had actually Ashley Elson from Palm Sounds on the show last week, and he talked about how incredibly huge a music messe was. He just came back from that, like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of industry that we don't necessarily think about too much because, we just give it as granted. Of course, hardware devices for music, but it's actually big bucks. So.
It's really big, and it's annual, right? It just keeps going. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can do a hardware release every year and updates, and it's definitely a good place to invest. That's it. I'm, from my end, I just came back from Miami from the Miami Music Summit. If you want to check out what happened there, if you go on mms.co, There's actually a live stream that was recorded that is still available for consumption. It's a bit long. It's a few hours long. Hopefully, they're going to segmentize it into different sessions in the next few days. It was an awesome time, and I never thought Miami was so interesting. So, and I never been there before. So it's kind of like, wow, there's a tech scene and there's, you know, all this stuff happening. It's amazing. Super exciting. And that's pretty much it. And I'm going to add, like I did in the last couple of weeks, I'm going to add a couple of interviews to this show towards the end. I'm definitely going to add the one with Kjartan Schletter, the head of strategy at Wimp, who had some really interesting stuff about streaming and the future of streaming, also when it comes to revenues or repartition and that kind of thing. And I'm just looking at my list now and deciding who I want to have. And I think I'm going to add the interview with Julian Mittelberg, the CEO at Bands in Town, as well after the show. So if you stick around, it's not going to end as usual. I'm going to have a couple of interviews right after recorded at South by Southwest a couple of weeks ago. Well, Sitar and Matt, it was a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much.
Likewise.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Digital Music Trends coverage of South by Southwest 2014. It's the last day. I'm here with Kjartan Schletter from the company Wimp. So hi Kjartan, I hope I did your name, surname justice.
Close enough.
Thanks so much for joining us. And so we're going to talk about Wimp. I haven't had a feature on the company in probably like a good 2.5, almost 3 years now. So
it's due.
It's definitely overdue, freshen up. So please, first of all, give us an outline of what Wimp is for maybe US listeners of listeners from territories where you're not present yet.
Yeah. It's a streaming service. That's a well-known category by now, of course. So I will try to focus more on how we are unique from the other services, because you have the 23, 25 million songs, you have the offline, but that is all, every service has that now. So what we're focusing on is great editorial. So we have local editorial teams in every country. So if you open the client in Norway versus Sweden versus Germany, it's different content-wise. We're currently live in 5 countries: Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, and Poland. Of course, looking to grow. Compared to other streaming services, we are stock listed.
Yeah.
Meaning that we have a different growth strategy than the more VC-funded companies. Sure. We have to have a more sensible growth. So we don't grow at the same speed, but we use a lot of time to understand the market and build up strong local editorial.
Sure.
So that's one thing. Other thing is we just launched video, music videos.
Oh, great.
That's the first service. I have already launched in beta magazine integration, so you can actually read, listen, and watch in the client. And we in October last year launched a hi-fi tier, offering lossless streaming at double the price, which has been hugely successful for us.
So there's a lot of ground to cover. So first of all, let's look at the international side of things. You are now live in several countries. So what has been your approach there? So you were talking about the fact that you're not VC funded, and so you have to have a different growth strategy. In that sense, you don't have a freemium offering, or do you? And how does that work?
No, we currently don't run with a freemium. We have tested it.
Yeah.
We had a freemium offering live in Denmark, Sweden, and Germany, and found that for our type of service and our type of customers, that didn't really work for us.
Right.
So we have now focused more on the premium plus position, offering actually higher price tiers than lower.
Yeah.
That said, we are about to launch a couple of initiatives in the marketplace that are aiming at like the low threshold users. But the traditional freemium model with stream as much as you want for forever for nothing, that is not the route we're going down. No.
Yeah. And so looking at the premium side of things, how do you acquire customers primarily? Do you have a particular strategy on that front?
Of course, and as I said, the streaming category is now well established. In Norway, 78% of recorded music sales are now digital. So, and streaming is most of that. So this is a well established category. So we don't have to, at least in our core territories, don't have to educate the users anymore. They know the service, they know the category. So now we're focusing more on how do we position ourselves compared to the competition. And we do that with the bullets I mentioned before.
Yeah.
Trying to be a more premium service than the others. So we're trying to, and we've always done this, trying to take what you loved with the physical record store,
yeah,
and bring that into the cloud. So it's not an empty algorithm kind of impersonal. It's people meeting people talking about music.
So when it comes to looking at, for example, carrier partnerships or integrations on home devices, what is your stance, and have you got any deals?
As I said, that's part of the hygiene factor. So yeah, all devices, and especially with hi-fi, the lossless here, you have to be on the Sonos, the Blue Sounds, and the NADs, every device, and now cars soon. And of course all mobile devices,
yeah,
of course,
yeah, yeah, sure. And so looking at where you're seeing consumers utilize the service the most, so is it always mobile devices, and if so, do you have your own app? How does the service work on a mobile?
Yeah, and I would imagine this is true for all services as well. If I should be very, very black and white or tabloid, usage is all mobile, and a lot of the usage which is mobile is offline. So that's by far the most important device or device type for us. Desktop is still important as part of the mix, but it's not what we, that's not where we see conversion being driven from. So it's a need to have, but not the end destination for the users. And we see the more devices the user have connected to his WIMP account, the longer he stays in the service, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I've seen a couple of reports recently talking about how, especially in Norway and in Denmark, they've seen a slight decline in the usage of local catalog as opposed to international ones. So
yeah,
what are you doing on that front? Are you working to help local artists to get
more exposure? Yeah, that's true. Especially so in Norway.
Yeah.
The latest figures point to between 12% and 15%.
Wow.
Which is dramatic. In the heydays of physical, it was 50. We can never get back to that because then you control the whole ecosystem, but 12 to 15 is too low.
Yeah.
That said, that's the average for the country. Our market share is between 35 and 45, so on local. So on our WIMP Hi-Fi tier, it's close to 50% actually. So we perform better than the competition, and that's because we are a local service, right?
Yeah.
But it's still a problem for the market as a whole. 12 to 15 is too low. So what we actually presented here at South by Southwest yesterday in a panel via a research partner called Clouds and Concerts, we work with, is an alternative way to settle in streaming. So currently the settlement model is you take all money, divide it on all streams, and then you get a market share. And we have been discussing now, and what we're discussing last afternoon here in South By, what if we settled each user individually?
Right.
And that has some interesting effects. One of them is that local market share increases by 13%.
Yeah, and of course I actually spoke to, was it Oleg that was driving, I can't remember the name of the researcher that was driving.
Arch.
Yes, of course. They were driving that initiative. I'm going to catch up with them hopefully soon.
Yeah, you should, because they're doing some very interesting research within streaming. It's not our research, but we have made the data available, and we think it's important to be a part of the discussion, because
yeah,
streaming is such an advanced category now in the Nordics, so we have to be able to drive it further. And I think this is an interesting discussion. How do we settle?
Yeah, absolutely. And so looking at music videos, so how have you introduced them as part of your service? We've seen, you know, for example, what was it? I think it was Xbox Music that recently introduced videos as part of the Xbox Live experience.
Correct.
Is it a similar take?
Yeah, and I would say that all services, if not this year, very, very soon will have videos. So it's going to be a hygiene factor.
That's awesome.
What we're doing with videos currently, we have introduced an Android client, which is a more curated experience, editorial
yep.
experience. Over the summer, we will deeply integrate videos in all of our clients. And that means that as a user, if it's a video track or audio track, you won't really notice. There will be perform in the same way, but of course you have the added effect of being able
of
to
visuals.
Watch it. Yeah. So yeah. You could imagine a playlist where you have both audio and video tracks intertwined, right?
Yeah. And I've been talking to a lot of services this week, and all of them are looking at dashboard integration. So are you working with any car manufacturers right now to see how WIMP can be integrated in the dashboard?
You mean cars?
Yeah,
of course. We have the discussions with all of the big players, and I would say that especially our HiFi tier is very interesting for them, because that's a service they can't get anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, we have more requests than we can handle, actually. So
yeah.
It's very exciting. I think that's exciting times. I think that's one of the most dominant trends this year. Is the total integration in all of our devices. Like every device is going online soon, and music will be a part of that.
Yeah.
Perhaps not in your refrigerator, but in your car, in your home stereo, and so forth, for sure.
Maybe even in our refrigerator. Who knows? Who
Perhaps.
Knows? I've seen I saw a connected slow cooker at CES.
We're launching WIMP Hi-Fi on that next year.
That's great. And so looking at, the company is evolving organically, in the sense that, you're trying to be sustainable in
yes.
the way that you're evolving.
Yes.
So when you approach the possibility of international expansion and looking at a new territory, what are the characteristics you're looking for in a new territory to say, okay, well, yeah, well, I think we should expand there?
It's the usual metrics: population, disposable income, broadband penetration, smartphone penetration, and so forth. But we also try to look at the maturity of the market. We are, for instance, in Germany, and you could argue that it's too early to be in Germany, because it's a very, very, very immature market, and our service is more of an advanced premium plus service.
Yeah.
So we also tend to look towards markets where streaming or other streaming players are already there and have taken the cost of educating the market, because we bring something different and can live next to the other services. Like Deezer and Spotify will probably kill... One of them will kill the other, because they're doing the exact same thing. We're trying to live next to them and offer something different.
So you were talking about curation. So how do you deal with the curation problem? We've been hearing a lot about this.
Yeah, it's one of the topics for this year, right?
Yeah.
We deal with it with humans. So we have algorithms working, of course, behind the scenes. But every piece of content or piece of music that is presented to the user via the clients is picked by someone.
Yeah.
So that's the route we're going. It's kind of expensive. You have to hire a lot of skilled people. It's kind of slow, because you can't grow in that. We couldn't launch in 100 countries, right? Because
yeah.
we need to be tailored to each one.
But that also means that you can go to each individual label that is relevant in that country and make deals and make sure that you have all the local catalog as well.
Yes. And we're seeing some launches that have been, we launched in 100 countries, but it's not actually launched. You can access it and you can go to the website, but the content is not tailored to the country, and the editorial is not tailored to the country. So... we have chosen a different route.
Yeah. And so when you do go to a new country and start speaking to labels, is there quite a lot of education that needs to be done around who you are and what you're doing?
Not anymore. No. We are, WIMP Music is one of the top 10 players globally. So we are on all the, we are being discussed in all the meetings at the label side. So they know us very, very well.
Yeah.
And the fact is that most of the negotiations are not with a single country, but from the central hub, London or New York. So I would say that the music labels or the music industry has come a long way in making it easier to grow. So that's not longer an obstacle. Rights management, however,
it's a problem.
Pain in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've seen, I had a chat yesterday about the fact that the Global Repertoire Database project is having a bit of a difficult time right now.
I'm not surprised.
So, apparently nobody wants to pick up the tab.
Yeah.
So,
that's a nightmare. And what the European Union tried to do has actually just made it more complex, since they're now competing with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So that is an interesting topic, but I don't have the solution, and I think no one has.
Yeah.
But I think that complexity hinders innovation.
Yeah, for sure. And we're seeing a lot of different approaches here in the US. You know, there's a lot of different points of view as to how things should work. On the product side, so sorry, we're talking about mobile. So do you have your own proprietary apps on mobile as well?
Yeah.
Android, iOS, Windows? Yeah.
Yes, as stated, hygiene factor. Yeah.
And on the radio side, a lot of companies that work in streaming are producing radio channels so people can listen to an endless stream of music.
Yeah, we do that as well.
You do that as well.
Yeah, and that's typically where the algorithms come in. So
great.
You can start from a playlist or a track or an album, and you can create a radio station out of that.
Yeah.
And that will be very interesting to see with videos, because I think with music videos, there's a huge untapped market in presenting them in an editorial manner.
Yeah.
So the best videos from a certain director, for instance. So
yeah.
I'm really looking forward to dive into music videos and present that in a fresh manner to the audience, not just rows of content, but curated and made fun.
Yeah. I mean, videos is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out in the home as well. So do you have like integration with some of the boxes or things that are working in the home?
Yeah, and that's a very interesting part of the market now, because we see that a lot of these Connect 2 devices are coming, like the Chromecast and others, and that's a very interesting domain to send videos to the big screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for sure, everything that is connected to entertainment in the living room is high on everyone's agenda, I would imagine.
Yeah. And finally, you know, you are in countries where streaming penetration is almost at the biggest it can get, essentially. You know, it feels like this year, certainly, streaming will conquer the vast majority of the market, and at that point, there's going to be very little room for expansion. So
I don't agree.
You don't agree?
No.
Okay, cool.
So in Norway now, we have 2 years with total growth. Digital market share 78% and streaming 65% or something. I believe there is still room for growth on two accounts. One is, of course, there's a user segment that hasn't adopted streaming yet, and that's the older population. And as this gets into more and more devices through their broadband connections, through their cell phone dealers, we can reach them. That's one thing. The other one is price. I believe that there is, I've seen it. There is a segment, if that's 10 or 20 or 30%, that's too early to conclude on. But there is a sizable segment that are willing to pay more for more. And I think that's one of the price point was the correct one, $9.99 or $99 in Norway, to get mass penetration. But we have lost the entire usage group from the physical dates that used to spend thousands of kroners or hundreds of pounds each month on CDs or vinyl, because you can't pay more than $9.99. So I believe there's a huge potential to drive parts of the market to a higher price tier, and that's what we've done now with WIMP Hi-Fi, which is double the price, and there's a double digit penetration of our users already. So,
wow,
so
that's incredible.
I believe in Norway we can get back to the same amount of revenue as in the peak year of 99-2000, the year Napster launched, and that in Norway is 1 billion, approximately. And if we can do that, I think we have done something that no one dared to believe in just a couple of years ago.
That's incredible. So yeah, essentially, the growth is not, you know, we don't have to look at the current market as the only potential market.
No,
we have
because,
to look at the market.
No, because the fact is that we have one price model in the marketplace, and that's all we see. And if you look at the telco, they typically have a multitude of tiers speaking to different usage groups. And you will see that in streaming as well.
That's great. And so just as a technicality for the listeners, what kind of streaming rates, bit rates, do you stream at with a hi-fi service?
That's lossless.
Oh, it's lossless.
It's lossless, yeah. So awesome. It's the uncompromised file directly from the record label. So there's nothing done with it. It's as intended by the artist.
That's great. And I'm sure like the fact that Neil Young got launched his Pono campaign as well.
Yeah.
Even if it's a different service, it will definitely raise awareness.
Yeah, I'm curious about the service and the name. And that's another story. It might have some kind of appeal on a global scale, but I can't see it, at least the Nordics, having a lot of penetration, because we kind of offer the same, just with 25 million tracks instead of the limited catalog. But I think it's very interesting that it's more focus on higher quality music files.
Yeah,
that's good.
No, that's a good thing. And I think I was the biggest skeptic of Bono before the actual launch, but now I understand. You know, they're gonna, target a very small section of the population, people that have very high end speakers at home and can use them. Because, you know, at my house, I don't have any $5,000 speakers to listen to 192 kilohertz tracks on. So
exactly.
You know,
so I
want to hear the difference.
Exactly. I welcome the initiative. I don't see it really working.
Yeah.
But the initiative is welcomed.
Definitely. And so, looking forward to the next couple of years, you know, what's the thing that's exciting you the most about the growth of WEMP right now?
It's if I should pick one thing, it's hi-fi, lossless streaming connected to the explosion in connected devices, because hi-fi really comes into its own in the living room. And with the Sonos and competitors, people are now increasingly having expensive hi-fi equipment at home. So for us, if I can pick one thing, that will be where I see the biggest potential for growth right now, both in revenues and in penetration.
Fantastic. And if people wanted to check out more about WEMP, of course, it's WEMP.com.
WEMPmusic.com.
WEMPmusic.com.
Correct.
Perfect. And you can find everything out. They have a very well maintained press release list as well. So you can read about all the latest news that they have over
That's
there
correct.
Too.
And I can be contacted directly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks so much. You can see behind me that they're starting to take the whole place apart. So I should probably stop recording right now. But no, thanks so much for your time. It was a pleasure. And thanks for tuning into the DMT coverage of South by Southwest. It's been a pleasure covering the conference. You can find out everything on digitalmusictrends.com or on youtube.com/digitalmusictrends. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends coverage of South by Southwest 2014. And it's a real pleasure to be here with Julian Mittelberg, the CEO of the company Bands in Town. So hi, Julian. Thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Great. How about you?
Great. It's the first day that I can actually shoot properly on the balcony. I love this balcony, but it's been rainy and then it's been cold, and this is the first
day
where we can shoot here.
Beautiful.
So tell me all about Bands in Town. I'm sure the majority of the audience will be familiar with the company already, but just in case, let's give a quick overview of the company.
Well, Bands in Town, at least for fans, is today the largest concert discovery app in the world. It basically helps fans never miss their favorite artist gigs, you know, and that's one of the big problem of the industry. Is a lot of people don't know that their favorite bands are coming in town, and they miss their show, and we're trying to solve that problem.
Sure, absolutely. And so when the company start out, it's quite a long history, right?
So the company actually started about 3 years ago in San Diego, and founded by, you know, four young people. And we teamed up about a couple of years ago with our company, Selfish, to accelerate that product. It started actually originally to be a platform for artists to help them better promote their tour dates. And then we launched a consumer product to help also fans never miss a show. And fast forward, you know, today, we're about to announce that we passed 10 million concert goers using the app.
Wow, that's a lot of concerts.
So it's a very lot of concerts, a lot of people. Yes,
yeah, that's great.
I think we said that aggregated our users combined about 1 million hours of concerts every week. So that's pretty big.
That's huge. So let's talk about the fan-facing services first, and then we're going to delve into the artist services and the APIs and all that. So if a user wants to use the app or the company, what happens? Where do they go?
So what we do is quite simple. The first thing we do is we try to know the kind of music you like. You know, so we look at your, if you download the app, you look at your iTunes library, we look at your, what you listen to on Spotify or on Deezer, what you thumbs up on Pandora, or what you like on Facebook or what you follow on Twitter. And based on that, we have an algorithm that make you track a number of artists. We think, you know, if you listen to a track for a number of times, then we think, oh, you like the artist, so we make you track this artist in Benzintown. Once you track an artist in Benzintown, you'll always be notified when they come to where you live. So the way it works is we have your music profile. We also have the largest database of events, upcoming events in the world. We cross that, we know where you live, and when the artist just announced a show that is coming to your town, then we'll let you know. And we let you know via mobile notification, via Facebook app, or via email.
So you're on all those platforms, right?
Correct.
Perfect. Both iOS and Android?
iOS, Android, Facebook app, voilà. And on the web.
Awesome. So talking about the band services, that you said that was the initial focus of the company. So what have you got in store for artists on that front?
So originally, the way it started is that artists on Facebook were having difficulties to display their tour dates. They didn't know where to put the tour dates. You had a feed. They had to post something. They had to create a Facebook event, link to the right ticketing company, the event, and the venue. So we just basically built a solution to do it automatically for them. It saved them a lot of time. Then we built an engine to post on their behalf so that, you know, if they don't remember how to post, we could post for them, geo-targeting to the right people at the right time, and they started to use us as a way to better display and promote tour dates on Facebook, then Twitter. Then we built a very efficient widget that they can display on their website.
So how's the artist adoption of it, and what is their reaction also to having a tool that allows them to do that?
So we've been very surprised. When Benzintown joined us, they had about 15,000 artists. We just passed 200,000 artists using this part of our application. About 65% of touring artists are now using Benzintown. So we have a pretty high penetration of that.
That's awesome.
Of that industry.
And so looking at the monetization side on both fronts, so on the fan side, is it more driven by affiliate sales of tickets, or what's the main draw there?
So the today, the main driver of monetization is actually to start offering promoters of shows a way to better promote their show.
Great.
To users, much more than affiliation from ticketing. We do send about 3 million people a month buying tickets. That's a lot. But, you know, the revenue stream from affiliation is not that great. Now, on the other hand, because we know exactly what our users like and where they live, then we tell promoters, you can actually have a bigger share of voice and create a dedicated campaign to promote your tour. Yeah. To our fans. And that's becoming very popular.
That's awesome. And on the artist front, do you provide any premium services for them?
No, we think that we'd rather just keep it, you know, free.
That's great. a lot so of many them, companies that are monetizing an artist on that front. So
I know, and I think that we have so many of them now. Yes, we have 50% of the top 40 artists, Billboard artists, but we also have a long, long tail of small artists. We don't think necessarily that they have the resources to pay. So we'd rather just offer that service for free, and actually, on the other hand, try to monetize with people with money, promoters. Or brands. So brands also are starting to be interested by the service. A lot of brands that are involved in touring and sponsoring would like to see more eyeballs on digital, and we think we can be offering that for them. So that's what we start to do.
That's awesome. And the company is really very much involved in the big data conversation around music, and you are also an early provider of API access to the service as well, and to your data. So how have you seen that space evolve over the last couple of years, and are you surprised by how prominent the conversations around the usage of APIs have become today?
So two things you're saying, big data and API. Let's start with the API. We've been offering the API since the beginning. The reason why is because in our mission to make sure that artists promote, can reach as many fans as possible, we cannot do it just by ourselves. So we're offering other services a chance to also display those tour dates. If you use Shazam, for example, when you Shazam a song and you have a list of options, including tickets, that's using our API. SoundHound, Reverb Nation, Bandpage is using a large part of our database as well. So we're trying to offer everybody a way to promote artists. Nokia now, all around the world, when you use their music services, and you have Gig Finder, this is also using Benzintown.
That's awesome. Yeah. And so on that front, how do you see that moving forward? I know that a lot of companies are looking at other APIs as a potential extra source of income. Are you monetizing the API right now?
No. I think that for us, it's really a distribution play. It's to say to the artist, you're going to be everywhere. And to make that happen, we're going to give everybody an opportunity to display your tour dates. It's key to understand that we're really displaying artist tour dates. We have a big catalog of events, but we always try to have all those tour dates validated by the artist so they can be official and then distribute them.
Yeah.
So that's where today, that's where we're seeing it. It's a free API. Anybody can use it. And I don't think I see in the near future a way to monetize it.
That's
now, on
great.
The big data side, it's a very hot subject, but we actually started with this. The only way we could really do an efficient product for our consumers is to be able to make it, to use big data to make it very simple. I like to say I use big data to make a very simple service. You receive a very targeted email or notification to tell you your artist is coming in town. To be able to do that, I have to go through all your music library many times. I have to go through all my event catalog, filter, and then give you the results. So that's the way we actually right now using big data. Big data is to provide a simple service. The second thing we're doing now is also to look at the way people behave when they go to show, when they post content, where reviews of the show, and try to also now go back to the artists and tell them, hey, maybe we have information that allows you to better route your tour.
Yeah.
You know, use it. So we're opening that to touring management and artists for them to start to use that to better prepare the next tour.
Absolutely. That's great. And so you were talking about some interesting things happening on the search side and SEO. So what kind of work have you been doing lately on that front?
Well, it's very new. Last night, Google made an announcement saying that they were now adding tour dates to their graph. And the way they do it is when they crawl a artist website, and they actually bump into our widget that we offer all artists to place, they will consider this content as the official tour dates of the artist.
Great.
And when you search the artist name on Google and you see the Google window where they list aggregate all this music information, you will see those dates also displayed. So now the artist through Benzindan can also control the first date that are shown on Google search results.
That's awesome. And it's good to see Google doing taking some more steps
at last
into helping artists, because I was a medium in a very heated session that I moderated there where Google got some slack because of some of the things that they were doing and the fact that we're not helping musicians enough. So definitely, I think that puts some
it's
salt.
About time. I agree.
Definitely about time. And so, looking forward, what are you really excited about when it comes to the company and its future development? What can you see for the next 12 months?
So, two areas of improvement and innovation. On the artist side, we're going to do something very interesting in the next, I would say, months and a half, is for the first time we're going to allow artists to communicate with our users. So on one hand, we have 200,000 artists. On the other hand, we have 10 million concert goers. The only way they communicate is when we notify users when the artist is coming in town. That's the only channel. We're going to open a new channel where artists actually can communicate directly with their fans.
That's fantastic.
For example, if you have 1,000 fans that RSVP to a show, and you want to say, hey, get excited, in 3 hours I'm there, get ready, and you want only to target those people, those artists will be able to use our platform to reach them out. Well, to reach out to them. So that's the first thing we're doing, is opening, communication channel between artists and concert goers.
Yeah.
On the fan side, in Q2, we're going to release a new version of our mobile app, which is going to add a stronger social layer to the app. We're adding some features where you're going to be able to see what your friends are doing, when they're tracking an artist, when they're going to a show, the kind of photos and videos they post about a show, other friends of friends, and artists also post, and try to have a destination where we can start to aggregate everything happening in Benzintown around one artist. Today, you have to go. It's very hard to get there. At one place, that's where we're going to go.
It's really crazy being here in the States, because you talk to artists and you really get to understand the hugeness of the U.S. when it comes to the concert market. Because, I talk to artists in the U.K. and, they can do a tour occasionally, but it's going to be a tour of the usual, 10, 15, 20 destinations. But here in the U.S., you can be on the road for a year and still not have covered the whole country. So I guess an app like yours is really, it comes into its own when you have these large, long tours and you have to, it's impossible to manage your fans everywhere. You have to really try and have some sort of automated process to do that for
you. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So I think on the artist side, it's true, but also on the fan side, since touring is now becoming the, you know, the biggest revenue stream for artists. You have more and more artists touring. It's not less and less, and longer and longer. So how can you help fans navigate through that? Of course, number one is to identify who they like and tell them who's coming. We also are now using a very solid recommendation engine where if you live in a smaller city, you may not have your favorite artist coming, but we still want to tell you similar artists coming that we think you're going to like. And actually, in our last survey, we found something very interesting. About 20% of our users have been to a show of an artist they didn't know before Bands in Town recommended them.
Wow.
It's very impressive. So we talk about music discovery. We're now launching concert discovery. And those are people that are spending $20-$40 to see someone they didn't know before because we recommended it. So it's also a very interesting new way of, you know, going to a show.
That's great. And on the other side of things, are you also looking at Latin artists know where they should go? If you can notice that, you know, you got like 2,000 fans in this random place that maybe you would never think about touring.
Yeah, good question. We have a feature we're adding into our consumer app. It's called Play My City. So if you're a fan of an artist and you see the tour just announced and you don't see your city, you know, listed on the tour, you have a function now that allows you to say, I want the artist to come to me.
Awesome.
And as we start to aggregate this data, we're going to share that with the artist so that the next time or even during the tour, they can even, you know, maybe add a date to a specific place. Perfect. And that's where big data, again, may be useful for artists.
Great. And Bands in Town is available worldwide?
So Bands in Town is worldwide.
Yeah.
It's only in English right now, but, you know, I think by the end of the year, we'll be localized. Our biggest markets are US, Canada, UK, Australia, Germany, France, and Brazil, believe it or not. So it's very, very spread out.
That's perfect. Well, Julian, it's a real pleasure. And again, it's bandsintown.com.
Yes.
And you can also follow the company. I'm sure it's at Bands in Town, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.